Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We've just been talking about the history of popular music over the last half century. Now we're going to turn to a format for listening to that music that was especially popular in the 1980s, the cassette tape. The compact cassette can be traced back to the 1960s, actually, a way to cheaply and conveniently record and play back music and spoken word. But in the 80s, it was revolutionary when the Sony Walkman allowed people to take their music with them via cassette. By the 90s, the cassette had been lapped by the CD, which then was eclipsed by digital platforms. But like so many elements of popular culture, what is old is new again, and the cassette has steadily become a favorite of collectors and retro enthusiasts. The history of the cassette is covered in a new series from our colleagues at Radiolab called Mixtape. The episodes explore the legacy of the cassette tape, how it's been used both as a tool of resistance and as a weapon of war. In the first episode, we hear how a mysterious proliferation of cassette tapes in the 1990s in China changed the musical culture of that country. Here's a clip from that episode titled Daco.
So he just followed the music.
Down the street and around the corner.
And he saw this store, and pretty much a hole in the wall. He stepped in, and he was just caught off guard completely. It was a store filled with tapes.
More than he'd ever seen in his life.
Yeah, wall-to-wall cassettes, hundreds of tapes.
And he's like, what the hell is this place?
He would be like turning around and there's Jefferson's airplane.
And Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley.
Turns around and there's like Bob Dylan.
Bon Jovi, Simon Garfunkel.
And then he turns around, there's Yes Band and really niche ones.
Like, is this for real?
It was everything you ever dream of in that tiny store.
Radiolab senior producer Simon Adler is the host, producer, composer, and sound designer of Mixtape, and he's in studio with me. Hi!
Hey, great to be here.
So on the first episode, you and Radiolab host Jad Abumrad, who is my generation, we are Gen Xers,
yes.
Talk about the amazing moment when you got a Walkman and you were able to put a cassette in and walk around. So we have nostalgia for it.
Yes.
You're a lot younger.
I missed out. I didn't get to experience any of it firsthand, no.
So how did you get excited about cassettes? When did you get excited about cassettes?
I got excited about cassettes maybe 2 years back. And it started actually with self-help tapes and instructional tapes. Sort of the pandemic was beginning to bear down on us. I was looking for something to listen to. And I was also very interested in sort of like what I've later come to believe was the proto-podcast, which was the cassette tape. Like, if I've done anything over the last 6 years, it's try to learn how to talk to people into their ears and teach them things or tell them stories. And I thought, like, let's look at some of the folks who did this before any of us folks are doing it right now. And that was these self-help gurus and these interesting instructional tape professors. So started collecting them and quickly became just fascinated by the idea that of how revolutionary this technology was because it was so new, because it was portable, because it was rewritable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the things we explore in the series.
If you look at the series and you look at the content of the series, we go from China to Bing Crosby's family situation to the Vietnam War. So when you were thinking about A, the research, and then B, the story arc, where did you start researching? And then how and when did the story arc become clear?
Right. Where did we start? That's a good question. Well, I knew I wanted to do a series about the cassette tape, and I knew that that meant I wanted it to be as sort of global as possible. And so it was a lot of just going into archives with keyword searches that had to do cassette tapes and then insert whatever verb or whatever adjective to sort of see what pops up. And one of the first ones that did pop up was this China Daco story, which is the story of how China, which was a really into the 90s, very, very limited in the music that was legal, sort of how Western music snuck in through a bunch of trash. Mm-hmm. And that one just sort of set me off in believing, like, holy smokes, these things did have just world-changing impacts that continue to reverberate today. From there, I think I found the one about Vietnam, where we're hearing sort of the weaponization of sound for the first time because of its mobility, mm-hmm. because of its cheapness, et cetera. So it really was just bouncing from one thing to the next to the next. And in terms of sort of when it all came together, I don't know. It's still coming together. So we'll see.
Before we get into the granular details of a couple of the episodes, what is a lead that you followed and then didn't go anywhere?
Ooh, one that was very interesting, actually, is that through today, one of the only ways that folks in federal prisons can listen to music is on cassette tape. Because there's basically this idea that the cassette is it's sort of a safe device that can't be turned into a weapon in any way, shape, or form. So if you want to send music to a loved one who's in a federal prison, you have to put it on a cassette tape. So there was just a way where it's still very present in people's lives. We looked into that. We couldn't quite find anything that was, I guess, quite surprising enough for us. But it's an interesting little factoid we came across along the way.
My guest is Simon Adler. We're talking about Mixtape, a special series from Radiolab. Listeners, if you want to get in on the conversation, what was the very first cassette you bought? Who did you make your first mixtape for? Oh, my gosh, that was like an invitation to other things.
Yes, yes.
When was the last time you bought a cassette tape? Should they make a comeback the way vinyl is? We'd love to hear from you. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Cassette tape enthusiasts, this segment is for you. So this is the interesting. You touched on the China episode. I want to go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Dako. So it means sawgash.
Yes, correct.
Explain why that's significant.
Right. Okay, well, it's significant for two reasons. So first of all, it's referring to the fact that all of these cassettes that showed up in China starting in the early 1990s, they all had this saw gash through them. Like there had been a circular saw run about an inch deep into the cassette, which was done to destroy it.
Huh.
The reason this happened was in the 90s, early 2000s, mm-hmm. It's just this period of decadence in the music industry. They're overproducing everything that anyone could want to buy. Every Michael Jackson cassette, they made a million extra. Nobody bought them. What do you do with all these extra cassettes? Nobody wants them. Well, what they were doing is they were destroying them, running a saw through them, and then selling them off into the international plastic scrap trade. And so at that time, China is developing, it's buying up all the raw materials on the planet. So what's showing up in this tiny town of Heping in the southeast corner of China, but barge after barge after barge of scrap plastic, including, the numbers are like 45 million of these cassettes
wow.
each year. And so folks were able to take these cut cassette tapes, put them back together. And this is really when you see this musical explosion finally happening in China.
What has been the legacy?
Basically, if you talk to any musician in China at the moment who is, I don't know, over 25, 30 mm-hmm. years old, they're going to point to these cassettes as sort of the moment their mind was open to sort of the possibilities. It was this cultural explosion that continues to reverberate today based on how folks consume music and maybe more importantly, how they're making stuff, because this music came in not with any history, not with any history book, not with even liner notes. So folks listening to this stuff didn't know that the Beatles came before Nirvana, or that I don't know that there's a difference between metal and punk. So there's this lovely amalgamation and creative recombination that continues to happen in China because of this sort of arrival of decontextualized music through these cassette tapes.
Our phone lines are filling up. Let's talk to John calling in from Manhattan on line one. Hi, John. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi, Allison. Cassette tapes were obviously used for music, but me and my friends, when I first got a cassette player, we used to make these radio plays, and like we were in the fifth grade, so we were really young. But, of course, it was fun technology for a kid. This was like pre-camcorder time. So this was pretty much the kids making their own movies, only in this case, it was radio plays. And the interesting part of it was that we entered an NPR Young People's Radio contest, me and my friend Lynn Martin. It was the highlight. I mean, it was the toy to have when you were a kid, and you kind of, this was sort of pre, before you got into, you know, music, which is, you know, high school. And it was just a joy to have cassettes and cassette players.
Thank you so much for calling in. Yeah, a certain radio host may or may not have interviewed herself as other people on cassette tapes in Glenridge, New Jersey. They exist somewhere. Let's talk about, I'm going to take more calls in a minute. Our screeners are going to town. But I want to talk about episode two, this Bing Crosby episode.
Sure,
it's really great because you give a lot of context for how huge a star Bing Crosby was.
Totally.
And that I'm not sure everybody really understands. What they say, he's like, if George Clooney met...
What is the line? George Clooney meeting... Oh, I don't even
recall.
It's like
Elvis or something.
Yeah.
Because he was everywhere.
He was huge. There is no one who compares or ever will compare again. Some of the statistics were, like, if you turned on the radio randomly, I think in 1948, there was a 50% chance that the voice that would be coming out of the radio would be Bing Crosby's. Half the songs on the radio were him. Like, that's just absurd. Plus, the guy was the number one movie star. He was putting out records every month on Decca. Like, he was the biggest deal any superstar will ever be, including the fact that he had a weekly radio show where a third of Americans tuned in. Like, Bing Crosby was a uniting force in a way that no man, woman, or child, I believe, will ever be again.
So it was a big deal when he decided he didn't want to do his show live.
Correct.
He wanted to record it.
Yes.
Now, that seems almost quaint right these days. But
Certainly. At
the time, it was a really big issue. What was the big issue?
Yeah, a couple things. Number one, radio's entire identity was that it was live. Like, very few people were pre-recording things.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, people tuned into Bing Crosby with the idea that they were sitting down in their living room, and their neighbor was, and they were listening to Bing Crosby as he was performing in real time. Bing didn't want to do that anymore. Number one, he would be letting his fans down if he stopped. But number two, there was no great way to record yet. Of course, we could record onto vinyl or shellac records. But back then, the sound quality of recording to vinyl or shellac was nowhere near as the quality of just running someone's voice straight through a microphone out onto the air. So there's a great fear that people are going to hear that this is recorded. They're going to hear the drop in quality, and they're going to stop listening. Which is, in fact, exactly what happened in 1946 when Bing started pre-recording his radio show.
What was the solution?
Well, the solution, fortunately, came in the form of a machine called the magnetophone and an audio engineer.
That sounds made up. Like it's in the X-Men, the magnetophone.
Exactly. Ah, magnetophone. Yes. The magnetophone and a guy by the name of Jack Mullen, who had found it in a bombed-out radio studio in Frankfurt. This was a device that the Nazi engineers had built, and it was just head and shoulders above any other recording device on the planet at the time. This thing could reproduce real life and sound better than anything ever. Jack, this guy, he finds this thing, he takes it home as sort of a trophy of war. He's an audio engineer, he fixes it up, takes it and shows it off to a bunch of Hollywood execs, Bing Crosby's producers there, falls in love with the thing along with Jack, and the rest is history.
Well, you have access to Bing Crosby's archives for this series. So let's hear a clip from the episode, which features a piece of tape that has probably not been played publicly except on your series. This is from Mixtape.
And stole a kiss in the night.
He would do a rehearsal run through, and then he would then do another performance, and both of those were recorded.
And so if something like this happened,
look at me.
Wait a minute, time. Wrong words. Go back a little, John.
I lost the place here.
It was no big deal.
I got carried away listening to my own voice.
They just grab the take of this song from the rehearsal and splice it onto that authentic feeling introduction from the version we just heard.
They were able to combine that, and so you could make the best possible show out of two different shows.
Get it on.
What's
schedule now.
But ultimately, Bing wanted even more flexibility.
This brings up the interesting issue of what is authentic, what is real, when you can make Franken audio.
Yeah.
Which still exists today. It's a huge issue today, still.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I say in the piece, I can't cast stones here. I work for a radio show where we edit things like crazy. But it's fascinating, and it's particularly fascinating when you look at it not just in the realm of us professional audio makers, but mm-hmm. sort of our daily choices about how we present ourselves to the world in social media. How authentic is the information we're putting out? And you see that question really first arise in 1946 between Bing Crosby and Jack Mullen, where there's this sort of this duality between whether or not we want to present something as it is, or maybe the version as we would want it to be.
Yeah, they add some laughter to a bad joke. Let's take a couple of calls. Alex on line 2 has been holding. Hi, Alex. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi, thank you. Amazing program. Love your show. I wanted to say that a couple of things. In the fifth grade, my first albums on cassette was Phil Collins' No Jacket Required, and Sting's first solo album, The Dream of the Blue Turtles. And I didn't even have a Walkman. It was one of those long, I think, Radio Shack ones that I think only lawyers use now.
Oh, you said Radio Shack. You just took me back to another time. Thanks for calling in, Alex.
Yeah.
Let's go to Lee on Bayside on line 4. Hi, Lee. Thanks for calling All of It. Lee, you're on the air.
Is that me? Oh, Les? Me?
Les. There. Oh, Les, I'm sorry.
Hi, how you doing? How you doing, Allison? Oh, I wanted to mention, I'm around 60. The cassette came out when I was in the 70s, and I'm a musician, I'm a music teacher, and as a guitar player, it was fantastic because you didn't have to drop the needle on the turntable anymore and find that little track. So you started, you know, recording all your tracks that you were going to learn the licks from and so forth and so on, and then they started putting, you know, variable pitch on it so you can actually tune up or down, a semitone, things like that. And then they had the looping factors later where you'd have, you know, return to zero.
Yeah.
So you're able to just cop all this music with cassette. It was just fantastic. I mean, it was a long time before I gave up the cassette. And I just wanted to mention something with your guest there talking about Bing Crosby. Bing is the guy who gave Les Paul his first reel-to-reel.
Well, without that, there you go.
Without that gift, he wouldn't have had multi-track.
Les, thank you so much. Just want to read a couple of folks are saying you can't talk about cassettes without talking about Grateful Dead. There's a looming danger of people taping over your stuff. That's a big issue. This woman says, Inside Out person says, I remember listening to my favorite song, Finger Poised Over the Button to Record, listening over and over to get the lyrics down. We're going to run out of time, but you're so kind to give us a brief preview of the next episode of episode 5, Help. Can you give us like 30 seconds?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's looking at the fact that self-help has been an industry for a long time. It was back to the 50s. However, it was really fledgling until the arrival of the cassette tape. Suddenly, people could listen to stuff intimately. These gurus and these instructional folks could talk directly to you, and that connection sort of allowed for this industry to boom. So it's an exploration of sort of the power of that connection that can happen once my voice can go directly into your and only your ears.
Let's listen to a preview of episode 5 titled Help.
This is an exciting program to put on tape.
When the cassette tape hit its stride, self-help as an industry really took off.
First step toward improvement.
Losing weight through the power of your mind.
And not just hypnosis tapes, but fitness and workout tapes.
Ready? Up, up.
Designed to help you sell Aerostar.
The unspoken strategies for gaining power.
Sales, marketing, and business tapes.
The goal of this tape is a transformation of your thinking.
Tapes on New Age spirituality, and instructional tapes on everything from
the wonders of the night sky,
stargazing to
assume that the airplane is flying in a normal attitude.
How to fly an airplane.
The airline transport cassette course.
This is one of my favorite callers says, I just finished writing a TV episode. One of the lead characters is a cassette tape based on a true story. So
of a cassette tape human being. Wow. A true story.
There you go.
Wow.
Simon Adler is creator, host, producer, and composer and sound designer of Mixtape, a special series from Radiolab. It is available now on your podcast platform of choice. Simon, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is Ira Flatto, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.